Research and Insights. I hope you enjoy the presentation.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our presentation on designing the evidence-based hospital. Really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to join us to discuss our latest insights on evidence-based design and ways the built environment can help providers deliver safer as well as more efficient patient care. Quick introduction, as Jade mentioned, my name is Patrick Test. I'm a consultant with the Facility Planning Forum here at the Advisory Board Company. In case you're not familiar with the Facility Planning Forum, we work with our design, architecture, and construction firms nationwide. Really excited to have with us today Ellen Taylor. She is the Director of Research for the Center for Health Design. Ellen brings more than 25 years of experience as a healthcare architect as well as a researcher. She's also been nationally recognized as an author and speaker on evidence-based design. During today's session, we'll be providing an update on the current state of research in the United States, as well as highlighting why we think evidence-based principles matter now more than ever as hospitals make the transition towards accountable care. We'll also be taking a look at those design innovations that can make a real difference for patients and staff within the inpatient space, as well as where hospitals should be prioritizing their investment based upon the associated costs of implementation. We've got a pretty full agenda for today's session, but also wanted to quickly note there's a separate resource guide that's available with additional tools and information on several of the concepts that we'll be focusing on today, and that's available on our advisory.com webpage. Before we get started, the Facility Planning Forum, we'd like to express our gratitude to the individuals and organizations that share their insights, their analysis, and most of all, time with us to support the project. The research team wants to especially recognize the following organizations for their contribution and expertise. With that, here is a closer look at our roadmap for discussion today. In the first section, I want to review the major market forces impacting the evidence-based design field and have a bit of a discussion around why delivery and payment reform have made research a must-have for hospitals and health systems. We'll also be touching upon, based upon our most recent 2014 survey, just how many architects and hospitals are using research today to inform project decisions. In the second section, this will be the heart of our discussion today. Ellen's going to be reviewing those areas where evidence-based design can make the most difference for hospitals as we're moving towards a value-based world. In particular, here we'll be looking at ways the built environment can improve patient safety, staff effectiveness, as well as create a healing environment within the inpatient space. And lastly, I want to end today discussing ways that architects can work together with hospitals to strengthen your own capabilities to evaluate, prioritize, and apply design research to inform project work. But first, I want to draw inspiration from perhaps an unlikely source, and that is the airline industry. Every day, millions of us step into airplanes, trusting we'll safely arrive at our final destination. And in a sense, we put our lives in the hands of the pilots, crews, and engineers that helped build the aircraft. Flying does remain the least dangerous mode of transportation available in large part because it's supported by decades of rigorous, credible research. The aviation safety movement, as you can see on the quote on the left there, is grounded upon evidence-based principles that have been tested and refined to minimize human error during flight. And to give you an example, the position of the cockpit, as you can see there, the controls have been designed to increase pilot situation awareness without causing information overload. The layout of the cockpit overall has also been standardized. And that proves especially helpful in those critical situations where you need a rapid response by the crew, and any hesitation or uncertainty about the correct operation is just vital. Sounds pretty familiar. Similarly, you have countless patients that fill up hospital beds every day, and they trust that they'll receive the best possible care. But historically, there wasn't rigorous testing of the built environment to evaluate their ability to support safer care for patients. Evidence-based design helps ensure that healthcare facilities are built according to the best available research. And just in case you're not familiar, we've included here the definition on the left. In short, evidence-based design is the process of basing decisions about the built environment on credible research to achieve the best possible outcomes. The notion of using design to impact outcomes, that's certainly not new, but putting in place an approach for applying and conducting design research, that's still gaining traction. For hospitals, an evidence-based process, it can help improve facility investment decisions by helping identify what are those elements that will have the greatest impact for patients. Important to note here, evidence-based design, it doesn't promise prescriptions or solutions. In fact, it recognizes that not all research is created equal, and it'll vary in the level of evidence. So we highlight on the right-hand side of this slide, the strength of evidence ranges from opinions of experts, that's towards the bottom there, to really rigorous randomized controlled experimental studies. Level one here is the highest level of evidence available, whereas level six is the lowest level. The good news is the research base evaluating the impact of facility design on patient outcomes has grown pretty substantially across the last decade. As you can see on the chart on this page, total number of reviewed publications doubled between 2004 and 2008, and then more than doubled again in the last 6 years, as you can see from 2008 to 2014. The explanatory power across these publications, it certainly varies, but the number of credible, pretty well-designed studies has also continued to rise. And this is certainly due to educational support and research from nonprofits like the Center for Health Design, as well as the AIA and Texas A&M and Georgia Tech's College of Architecture. With a larger research base, we know for the designers on the call today, you have access to much more rigorous research that demonstrates the positive impact of the built environment on the delivery of care. And today, that impact on patient outcomes, it matters more than ever for hospitals. As Medicare, as well as commercial payers, they continue to transition providers away from fee-for-service and this volume-based world that we've lived in for so long to value-based payment, hospitals are facing some significant pressure to improve clinical performance as well as the patient experience. Great example is Medicare's value-based purchasing program. This is their most notable pay-for-performance program that's in place right now. And you can see facility design now has a direct impact on provider reimbursement. Important to note here, this isn't a pilot and it's not voluntary, so any hospital that bills Medicare, unless they meet a specific exemption, is going to be subject to value-based purchasing. The way it works is that Medicare will withhold a portion of revenue between 1 and 2% that is later redistributed based upon a set of quality metrics. And you can see here, while a portion of that is patient outcomes and clinical process of care metrics, 30% in fiscal year 2014 was the patient experience. If you're familiar with the HCAHPS survey that they use to evaluate patient experience here, it asks questions like, how well do physicians do at communicating with patients? How responsive was the staff? In some ways, all the questions can be connected to the built environment, but we've included here several that we know are directly impacted, and that's the level of noise at night, and we're going to be discussing different strategies for impacting that through design, as well as the cleanliness of the environment. As a result, a lot of the providers we speak with are starting to think of facilities more than just a cost center. They're a strategic investment that contributes directly to their bottom line, especially as we're making this transition to accountable care. We're starting to see the adoption of evidence-based principles as a result. On the left hand of the slide, this is our most recent data from our 2014 survey we completed back in February, and we asked the architects and designers that we worked with, how many of you are implementing evidence-based design research and using it to inform design decisions? You can see large majority indicate they're leveraging research on a regular basis to support decision making. And hospitals as well also say they're implementing evidence-based principles in most or all new construction projects. Pretty impressive when you look at a high level, but of course this is aggregate data, and it doesn't hone in on the adoption rate of specific design features that have been supported through research. When we take a look at how frequently hospitals have implemented individual design features, there's a range of different evidence-based design innovations that unfortunately are being under-deployed. Only 60% of organizations or less have used the following design elements shown here that work to strengthen patient safety. Now, to be fair, we know each of these design innovations is going to vary by the strength of supporting research, as well as the cost of implementation and how effective these principles are at actually achieving the desired outcomes. But even when you look at a relatively low-cost innovation with a lot of evidence behind them, like in-room hand wash sinks, which help encourage staff compliance and reduce the spread of pathogens, they're not always leveraged to their full potential within hospitals. And we know that can have real consequences for patient safety and outcomes. A great example is the hospital-acquired infections. These are infections that patients acquire during the course of receiving healthcare treatment for other conditions. Hospital-acquired infections, they're one of the most prevalent as well as deadly problems impacting patients. Each year, they affect hundreds of thousands of Americans, which leads to greater costs, longer recoveries, and a lot of preventable death. We showcased on the left here, this is the estimated healthcare-associated annual mortality. It's estimated that the healthcare-associated infections responsible for more deaths than heart failure and breast cancer combined on an annual basis, and that's an incredible statistic. There is growing recognition by both the infection prevention as well as design communities that the built environment can play a role in preventing hospital-acquired conditions. On the right, some evidence that design can help prevent the spread of pathogens through either direct or indirect contact by placing alcohol-based hand rubs at the point of care. Important to note here, in this study, the hand washing compliance itself wasn't evaluated, but it is likely that it did play a role in this improvement. Second, design can help minimize the transmission of airborne pathogens. Example, we know that the installation of a high-efficiency particulate absorption filter in rooms where there is immunocompromised patients can be an effective solution, especially when it's used together with other risk mitigation strategies. Given the increasing awareness of the positive impact of the built environment on patient outcomes and certainly high stakes for hospitals that you might be working with as architects, in the next section, Ellen's going to discuss where can hospitals prioritize their efforts and review some of the most effective design solutions that we're seeing within the inpatient space that really make a difference.
Great, thanks, Patrick. So as Patrick outlined in his introduction, there's three areas that we're going to be talking about in this section, and this is really focusing on patient safety first, as an emphasis has been placed on this area from the 1999 report to Errors Human and the follow-up report in 2001, Crossing the Quality Chasm. It's interesting that those reports came out more than a decade ago, but we really haven't seen significant advances in the area of these safety outcomes. And we're really now in the position that hospitals are being measured more accurately in this reimbursement through value-based purchasing, and the inpatient prospective payment system is really aligned with trying to achieve and change some of these outcomes. So today, more than ever, it's important for hospitals to focus on safety and really improve these outcomes. And the second area that we'll talk about does relate to staff effectiveness. We spend a lot of time talking about the patients, but the facility design can also influence staff outcomes as well. And it's really important in an era of constricted resources where you're trying to maximize your efficiency, reduce waste, and really do more with less. And then last, we're going to talk a little bit more about the healing environment. And this is really about strategies that can enhance the patient experience, improve patient recovery and outcomes. And Patrick had mentioned HCAHPS. You know, there's many organizations that are focused on this as a measure right now, and noise, for example, is just an area of challenge that most organizations continue to struggle with, and there's certainly built environment solutions that can help on that front. Patrick, next slide. So the first thing that I really wanted to talk about is something that's become pretty much a standard in the United States based on the guidelines that were output in 2006, and this is the use of private or single-bed patient rooms. And maybe more than any other design development, this has the greatest potential to improve patient safety. And we're going to talk about it a little bit here now, and then I'll talk about it towards the end of this section as well. But this is something where there's a pretty compelling body to look at a range of quality improvement outcomes, whether it's infection control, fall reduction, medication errors, privacy, decreased noise, or environmental control. Some of these areas may be stronger than others, and some of these may work more in conjunction with some other solutions to really provide the outcomes that you're looking for. But it's really one of the most visible and tangible ways for a patient, at least, to be able to identify how up-to-date is my facility and what might be the sense of how committed they are to patient-centered care based upon the types of things I see in an inpatient unit. But there's still an important question. So we can talk about the concept of single-bed patient rooms, but what are the specific design elements that really needed to be included within that, and what is the right layout, and what are the right types of amenities? And we don't have answers to all of these questions. And in some cases, we may never have all of the answers. It may always depend on the patient population, the culture of the organization, or the culture of the community that it supports. But one key design element that is really important in terms of looking at the single bed patient room has to do with infection control, which Patrick mentioned before. But you can start to look at these other considerations as well, whether it's bathroom location, nursing station configuration, HVAC systems, family space. You know, this is one of those areas in particular where there really is no definition how much is enough space when you're talking about family space. But it does act together as a whole. And there's been studies that have really started to look at what are some of the impacts in relationship to some of these different outcomes. And for example, in one study, there were results that found that there was a 10 to 11% reduction in different types of infections that were due to the exposure of roommates or the associated activity of having a roommate in the room with you. So again, there's a holistic approach that needs to be taken into account. There's a system that really works together. But you can start to look at how these different components might actually start to impact those outcomes. Next slide. So I had referenced this earlier, the whole notion of hand hygiene locations and hand wash sinks is something that, again, is becoming more and more common and is actually a code requirement in most areas at this point to have some type of a hand wash sink outside of the patient toilet room itself. But there's things that you can do within this as well. It just doesn't have to be a sink. And it doesn't have to be just a basic utilitarian device. This is a case study from the Dublin Methodist Hospital, and they really took advantage of trying to highlight this safety feature, and they really used design as an important consideration. So you can see things like the stripe that really visually leads you to the sink area and the downlight that really focuses that area on the hand hygiene location. So this is immediately visible when you walk into the door, And what's also important is that you can actually see this from the patient bed as well. So not only is the care provider being reminded when they walk into the room that this is something that I need to do, but the patient can also pay attention to whether somebody is washing their hands before they come over to be treated. So Dublin had some really great results about a year after they opened. Through the surveys that they were taking, they found that they were in the 94th percentile of hand hygiene compliance, and with hand hygiene compliance depressingly low throughout the nation, this is really an exceptional result. And of course, if you've ever heard Cheryl Herbert, who was the former president of the hospital, talk about this, she was still concerned about what's wrong with the last 6% and why can't we get it to 100. But there's always going to be a little bit of a challenge in trying to get everybody to comply all of the time. But especially at this point in time, where this was something that was really a focus of a lot of different organizations, the national average was just tremendously low. And in one study that's highlighted here with the 50% rate, they had looked at different facilities across the country and found that the hand compliance rate had moved from 36 to 51% in a very specific proactive set of behavioral changes that they were asking people to make. So the fact that Dublin was able to achieve this 94% is really pretty remarkable. Next slide. So another area of patient safety that is a high area of focus right now, especially as it relates to reimbursement, is the issue of falls, and especially fall with injury. So the private room, there's some questions about whether private rooms actually contribute to some of this, but there's certainly a number of features that can be used to really enhance some of the outcomes here. So there's different components that you might actually be able to consider. And this is an example from Palomar Health. And you can see that one of the things that they've done in the picture on the left is that the patient bathroom is on the head wall. And this is something that is considered by many organizations. Should it be on the head wall or the foot wall? Should it be inboard or outboard? And in this case, I think there's a really innovative solution in terms of the configuration of the room and the layout having the slightly angled wall, in that the bathroom is on the head wall, which allows the patient fewer steps between the bed and the bathroom entrance. It allows the opportunity to install a handrail between the bed and that bathroom entrance. But the angle also allows somebody to have visibility into the bathroom as well. So you're actually able to accomplish a number of goals through the same design feature. And there's really an important consideration in terms of both distance and visibility for somebody to be able to ambulate to the bathroom themselves. The other thing that Palomar considered here was this extra wide door into the bathroom. Typically, it's very challenging for a caregiver to actually assist somebody into the toileting area. So this extra wide door really allows for the caregiver to be able to assist, or a family member if possible, and actually can reduce staff injury as well. So there's some other components that you can look at as well. You can look at the flooring material, so having non-slip flooring in the bathrooms, having curbless showers, having no transition between the patient room floor and the bathroom floor is an important consideration. But one of the other things that Palomar really looked at was this neutral floor pattern within the room. So there is some variation and there is a design that's incorporated there. But this decision came out of a mock-up scenario where they had patients going through the mock-up, and they had apparently much more contrast in the floor design originally, and somebody commented to say, oh, I'm not sure if my aging parent would perceive that as being a flat floor or not. And there's actually research that alludes to this as well, that the contrast can lead to some trip hazards or some fall hazards. So they ended up sort of muting this a little bit more, and it's really, quite a lovely solution, providing a little bit of variety, but taking that safety consideration into effect as well. So part of the challenge is that it's not just one thing, right? So we would all like to think that, we do this and we can impact the outcome, but it really is this combination. It's a multifactorial approach that we really need to consider. So it's not just the built environment, it's not just behavior, it's not just procedures and protocols, but it's how all of these really start to work together. You have to have good risk assessment policies. You have to have rounding protocols. You have to have that culture of safety. You have to have people comply with the things that you want them to do. But underlying all of that is the built environment. And a lot of times this really gets lost. People don't realize that this is something that can really impact change and can really be used as a tool for change. Conversely, if you have the opportunity to be designing a project, whether it's a new construction or renovation, this is really your opportunity to take a little bit of extra time to really think through some of those decisions and understand what are some of those things that you might do differently, because that decision may be harder to change once you finish the project and once you're occupying the facility. So another thing that's happening, and this is very new, actually, this has just come out in the new 2014 FGI guidelines for design and construction of hospitals and outpatient facilities. This is the notion of incorporating a safety risk assessment. And this is really addressing the theories that were developed more than 30 years ago at this point for high-risk industries, where people really started to understand that there's underlying conditions, which are sometimes called latent conditions, that result in these active failures. So that's the thing that we actually see going wrong. And it's really sort of taking that approach of root cause analysis and stepping back a few paces and saying, what were some of the things that actually led to this event happening? It's not just that somebody made a mistake. They made a mistake for a reason, and they probably made a mistake for more than one reason. So there's a Swiss cheese model that's often used to look at how accidents can actually get through some of these holes within the system, and the more slices or barriers that you may have to sort of stop some of those accidents from happening, the better off you're going to be. So again, the built environment can become one of these layers of defense, and within that single layer, there's obviously multiple things that you might be able to consider. So the concept of the safety risk assessment in the 2014 guidelines is really to take an overall approach. It's not to say you have to do all of these different types of assessments, but it's really saying take the concepts of the ICRA and the FAMA and what was psychiatric injury in specialty hospitals and apply that to some new considerations as well, whether it's falls that we've talked about or medication safety, immobility, or security. So we had mentioned noise before, and as you can see from this chart, the scores in the area of noise continue to be miserably low. So there's certainly room for improvement across all of the areas that are measured in HCAHPS, but noise continues to be, I think, everybody's number one struggle. And we know that there's lots of things that can be beneficial to patients through the noise reduction, but sometimes it's a combination of behavior, it's a combination of policies, and you know, as we've discussed, it's a combination of built environment components as well. So it's interesting that, you know, many organizations still struggle with this, and for the most part, people really try to look at behavioral change and perhaps overlook some of the things that they might be able to do within the built environment. Next slide. So this is Palomar again. We talked about their patient room design, and they had actually done a study before they moved into that new facility that really looked at how can we address this issue of noise in a way that is cost efficient and addresses some of the cultural issues that we have as an organization. So they did a little bit of an experiment within two units of their existing facility, and they looked at this in three phases. So in the first phase, they took the two units, and both of which had older carpeting and your standard acoustical ceiling tile. And then in the second phase, they replaced the flooring material, and they had one unit that received carpet and one unit that received a hard surface flooring, a resilient tile. And then in the third phase, they actually took the unit that had the hard surface flooring and put in a high-performance acoustical ceiling tile. And at every phase of the project, they measured the sound levels, but they also took surveys of both patients and staff to understand the perceptions of noise, because it's not just about the decibel levels. It's about the perception of the sound source. It's about some of the changes in comparison to the ambient noise level and how disruptive that can be. So they really tried to capture both quantitative and qualitative information. And the interesting thing that they found was the combination, that third phase combination of the harder floor with the high-performance acoustical ceiling tile, basically got them the same results as the carpet with the standard acoustical ceiling tile. And for them, this was a really important decision to make, and for them, this was really the right decision. So carpet may have a lot of benefits for a lot of organizations and in a lot of different areas of the hospital, but it's not necessarily the right decision for everyone. And from this study, they were able to make an informed decision about what they were going to do moving forward. And I would just like to note that in that third phase, what they didn't have an opportunity to do was to look at the combination of carpet and the high-performance ceiling tile, which you can imagine would have given even better results. But it's projects like this that can really help other organizations with that decision-making process. It's sharing that information and understanding that sometimes you don't have to have a big project to be able to undertake some of these smaller scale research initiatives to really help you with what your decision might be. So this was a simple renovation project. This is the kind of project where when I need to replace the flooring, I might have the option to look at two different materials and how might they fare. Next slide. And this starts to tie into an even more sensitive environment. So noise is important in adult environments, clearly, but it's even more important when you look at areas like NICUs. So noise, lighting, all of these issues associated with preterm babies that are so sensitive and don't have the physical ability to sort of handle some of the sensory overload that can happen within this kind of environment. This just becomes a real area of challenge for many organizations. And again, the built environment can just be a huge help within this. So this is an image of the Rainbow Babies Hospital at University Hospitals in Cleveland. And this is actually a really interesting case study, at least for me, because Rainbow Babies is well regarded for all of the work they've done in neonatal care since the 1960s. And some of you may recall the name Dr. Benjamin Spock, but he actually pioneered the concept of the family even being allowed into the NICU, which may sound odd today, but you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago, this really wasn't the norm. And in fact, Rainbow Babies was the first hospital to actually use the single room bassinet concept. And Dr. Michelle Walsh, who's the current medical director of the NICU, was the lead author in a groundbreaking study about light and sound in the NICU back in 2001. So they've always been on this leading edge curve of what happens in NICU design, and they really wanted to take advantage of this progressive thinking with their design team. So their design team really came up with an array of solutions that could be used. So there was acoustical ceiling tile that we just talked about, but they also used some acoustical wall panels. There's multi-level lighting controls so that the family members and the staff can actually control the environment as it's suited for the particular condition. There's individual temperature controls. There's wireless paging systems to, again, try and reduce the noise level. There's webcam monitoring. There's advanced air filtration systems. And this is really sort of addressing so many different fronts with so many tools within the toolbox, so really a great example of how design can be effectively used to really look at some of these positive outcomes. Next slide. And this is another NICU example. So this is one that hasn't been built yet. This is slated to open in 2015. This is the MedStar Franklin Square Medical Center. And they too have sort of expanded on this notion of what needs to happen within the NICU room. So you know, we take some of those concepts that we've learned from adult acute care and we look at the implication of the zoned room where you have the family zone and the staff zone and the patient zone, in this case the infant zone, and really try to look at the best configuration for that so that we don't have conflicting functions happening within the room and we're really supporting the level of care, patient-centered and family-centered care that we're trying to provide. So this is, you know, another interesting example of the evolution of NICU design, and it will be interesting to see, you know, how this actually starts to evolve over time and how this is increasingly becoming a standard within organizations as the single bed family or single bedroom has become in acute care environments. So, you know, having this ability for the family to spend time with the baby, for the mother to have an area for breastfeeding, for kangaroo care, which is that skin-to-skin contact, this can really have a positive impact on preterm infants. So it really is the wave of the future for NICU design. That said, just like with single bed patient rooms, there's always going to be discussion. And there's certainly some challenges that can exist within a single family NICU. This is a newer model for many people. And just like we had to go through with decentralization and private rooms and acute care units, there's definitely some issues associated with perceptions of the ability for communication, for patient monitoring. You know, it can be very challenging for nurses who are used to seeing everything happening at once to suddenly be in the position where they have to have a slightly different way of viewing patients within different areas. Similar to acute care and adult environments, they may feel more isolated within this kind of model where they're used to having all of the commotion and activity going on. And it takes time to adjust. And it really takes a proactive initiative on the part of the organization to try and address this and recognize that this isn't something that's going to change overnight. But with solutions such as alarm management, that can monitor some of the different conditions that are happening in the room, call buttons that go directly to your care nurse, camera monitoring, ways for the staff to easily monitor patients from a distance. All of these tools that have been used in adult environments can really be leveraged here as well to support improved nurse coordination in this kind of care model. So again, it will be interesting to see how this develops over the next decade. Next slide. So this ties into decentralization, which we just talked about a little bit, but the notion of having a single bed patient room, whether it's in a NICU environment or adult environment, really does need to be supported by some type of decentralized nursing and decentralized supplies. So the concept of the nurse hub perhaps is not the most appropriate way to go forward, especially with units that are inherently bigger by having single bed patient rooms. But there's other benefits as well. So if you've been in an older hospital that has one of these centralized nursing stations, especially at shift change, you know how noisy it can be. In fact, there was one study that looked at this and found that there was a noise level that was equivalent to a jackhammer at shift change, which is just remarkable that I've seen it happen, and it's not unusual, unfortunately. So having a decentralized environment where nurses are less likely to congregate in that single area and have loud discussions, having that handoff at the patient room or right outside the patient room becomes very effective, and then also having that decentralized supply location. So this is the Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago, which opened in 2012, and they have a series of what they call porches outside of each two patient rooms. And what they try and do is have that patient handoff happen at that location at the shift change. But they also have open team collaboration areas that happen at certain points within the unit so that you can have more of a team conversation, before you move into that porch area. And then they also have enclosed team conversation spaces in the form of conference rooms that are also centrally located to the unit so that you have multiple ways that you can actually work within the unit, and you have flexibility for caregivers depending upon what's happening that day or what's happening at the moment. Similar to the way that they provided options for how people might be able to work together, they provided options for how supplies and equipment are decentralized as well. So there's multiple areas where supplies and equipment are kept. Some of it is kept much closer to the actual patient room. Some of it is kept within storage and equipment supply areas that are central to the patient unit. And then some of it is just off of the unit. And it's all based upon the frequency of use of different items on where it's kept. And the goal for them has really been, how can we standardize those components so that everybody always knows where that particular unit is, so that you don't have to spend all of that time hunting and gathering and walking up and down the unit to find what it is you're looking for. So standardization is something that we can talk about in the context of supply storage and equipment placement, but this is really effective in the context of what people really want to focus on, which is patient care. So it's about having the right tools at the right time, what I need, where I need it, when I need it. I'm able to do the thing that I really need to do rather than be frustrated while I'm trying to go and find something else. So Ann Hendrick and Marilyn Chow had done a study that some of you are probably familiar with to look at what nurses do during their shift. And a significant amount of time is actually spent in hunting and gathering for supplies. And the notion of decentralization and standardization is really trying to be able to get people to spend more time at the patient bedside in that direct patient care rather in those non-value add activities. Next slide. So the conversation of standardization of supplies and equipment then inherently starts to lead into the standardization of the patient room as well. And you start to get into the question of same-handed rooms and whether that actually impacts staff efficiency and safety as well. So this is the St. Joseph's West Bend project from 2005. And while some of this may have been happening before, I think this was the first project where people really started talking about this issue in earnest. And it was certainly one of the first projects where this was really published and really discussed in this way of using that aviation example, using everything that had been learned from human factors in aviation to say there's cognitive burden associated with doing things in different ways. And by standardizing the room and having this same-handed configuration, people always know what to expect when they go in the room. And this was really the concept that was developed with that same handed room. But the evidence maybe is still a little bit out, so there's not a lot of research in this area, and this is one of those areas that I think becomes a little bit of the urban legend or the myth where, oh, well, we've already studied that. You know, we know that same handed rooms are good, or there's no research to support that. And the reality is that there's really only a couple of studies that have been published in peer-reviewed journals, and a lot of the other information may be more anecdotal in nature, or maybe something that is presented at a conference, which is still great, but hasn't necessarily been through that higher level of scrutiny. So there should be questions asked for some of these other studies that you see. But I think the bottom line that we can draw from the two studies that have been published is that there's certainly evidence to support standardization. I don't think that there's really clear evidence to support the same-handed concept. So Debajati Patti had done an experimental study with his colleagues that was published in 2010, and they looked at a test-type condition with different scenarios with 20 different nurses, half were left-handed, half were right-handed, and they really tried to look at the difference between a standardized mirror configuration and a standardized same-handed configuration. And what they found, interestingly, was the nurse behavior wasn't consistent. So the whole issue of whether it was same-handed or mirrored didn't necessarily have the results to change any of that behavior, but the standardization was important. And in both of their scenarios, they did have a standardized environment. Nick Watkins and his colleagues that published their study in 2011 found that there were benefits with the same-handed unit in relationship to noise levels and related sleep quality. And there were more approaches to the patient's right side, but they talk about it in the context of the balanced head wall. So again, there's other ways to look at a mirrored configuration by having a standardized system. So I think this is an area that definitely needs more study, which both of these authors acknowledge, and is really something that warrants the discussion of, you know, what is the difference between standardization and handedness, and are there other cost-effective ways that we can try and address this? So in terms of reducing noise levels between the rooms, you know, there might be other considerations to reduce those noise levels as well. So ultimately, what is the cost of all of this, and what is the payback? So these are some numbers and some of the design features and outcomes that are brought from the Fable 2.0 hospital. And this is really based upon a hypothetical $350 million hospital with 600,000 square feet. And they came up with some average costs. This may vary by region. It may vary according to the scale of the hospital. But again, this is drawing a line in the sand, outlining your assumptions, and is really developed to create a storytelling device. How do you start that business case conversation with someone? And this is really a great framework to start looking at what would be the incremental cost for doing certain things in a different way. How much would it be to include ceiling-mounted lifts within all patient rooms? How much is it to do a slightly larger patient bathroom with a wider door so that a caregiver can assist? How much more is it to include a healing garden? And then start to look at what are the potential outcomes? You know, what actually happens with some of this where we have a complicated system of outcomes, as you can see from all of the different lines, that really, you know, speak to that bundled approach. So we talked about private rooms earlier and the concept of how this can really have the potential to lead to a safe environment. But the reality is that the private patient room needs to be accompanied by things like decentralized nursing, by things like effective HVAC systems, by hand hygiene sinks. So all of these things combine together, and you can see that different design features can be associated with different outcomes, and different outcomes conversely back to different features, so that you have a little bit of a cobweb. But again, this really, it creates a framework for having that discussion, and it can really start to lead you down the path to say, how would we evaluate it within this organization? And if we have time, we can certainly talk about this in more detail. This could be a whole conversation on its own. This is a simple payback method. So from a financial perspective, this doesn't include financial discounting. It doesn't look at the opportunity costs of other projects. This is, again, much more of a storytelling device.
Great. Thank you so much, Ellen. And to pull up for a moment, we just discussed those principles, as Ellen alluded to, that work to improve patient safety and create the healing environment. and strengthen staff effectiveness, like the distributed nursing stations in hospitals. Next, I want to shift gears just a little bit, focus on different ways architecture firms and providers can work together to build up capabilities to evaluate and prioritize and ultimately apply design research in your project work. We've summarized the evidence-based design process on this slide that serves as the framework for this next section. Starting from left to right, first is correctness. Are we basing design decisions on trustworthy sources of evidence as it relates to the project you're working on? And once we determine research accuracy, second is prioritization. Do we have a method to prioritize design principles? And taken collectively, the goal of those first two steps is to evaluate the available research that's out there. Next, implementation. Do architecture firms and hospitals proactively work together to apply evidence-based design concepts? As we'll see, the applicability of research in any given case is separate from its scientific merit. And then lastly, assessment. Does our organization collect baseline performance metrics and then evaluate the impact of design post-occupancy? Let's go ahead and jump in by looking at strategies to ensure that the research you're using is correct. Unfortunately, on this front, a number of perennial challenges to evaluate the accuracy of design research, starting on the left, up until probably the last 5 years or so, there's been no standard glossary of evidence-based design terms, definitions, and measurement tools. And that makes it difficult to conduct apples-to-apples comparisons across research studies as well as benchmark across different organizations. Second, as you can see in the center, there is no commonly accepted method for assessing the strength of evidence. And that's a huge problem because, let's face it, the evidence that's out there is not all created equal. Research evaluating the impact of design, as we've seen, it can vary greatly in terms of their validity and reliability, and it's therefore important to understand the level of evidence when you're using research to inform decision making. And third, there's been a lack of a central database for storing and distributing research findings, which makes lit reviews to identify what's the best available evidence pretty difficult. There are effective, easy-to-use tools that are out there that are emerging that you can use as both an architecture firm as well as a hospital to overcome these challenges, including several from the Center for Health Design that we'll be mentioning. First, every architecture firm can strengthen their process for evaluating research by adopting a framework to think about the strength and quality of evidence. And here we showcase a practical and accessible, hopefully, conceptual model for thinking about what can be considered evidence to inform design. First, starting at the far left there, firms should determine a study's scientific merit. So this is questions like, did the research include an experimental design? Did it have controls? Was there a randomization? If not, what type of study design was employed? Here we want to determine the extent to which the experiment will identify and rule out alternative explanations. Second, within any study, it's important to take a closer look at the methods and tools it uses to evaluate results, and we should be asking questions like, was the sample size too small to make reliable comparisons? Were meaningful and appropriate statistics used? And that's to evaluate the validity of the study. Does it evaluate what it says it does? And then its reliability. To what degree does the tool produce stable results over time? And then lastly, I think most importantly, how applicable is the research? Even if a study has a high level of credibility, it still might not answer the design question you're looking to solve. So as a result, firms need to assess the appropriateness and the feasibility of applying that concept into practice. We've assembled a resource guide that goes into much greater detail to support your ongoing evaluation of research, and this will be available on advisor.com following the presentation if you're interested in some more detail here. We know that finding accurate design research can often be half the battle. And in our discussions with architects and designers, this has come up time and time again that there's no shortage of information out there, whether that's past projects or site visits, published research, and so forth. But actually having that information in one location is a challenge. As a result, we are starting to see some firms create their own database that can serve as a repository to gather and share design research. And as we show on this slide, a database would combine secondary literature as well as lessons from project work in the same location, which allows architects to use that information to inform decision making. I think most importantly, it makes sure that you're getting the most out of data that usually sits dormant from past projects. But there's also an education component here of sharing information across the firm to educate staff on the latest design innovations. Of course, we know databases, they require constant upkeep and organization, which costs you time and money. So not feasible for every organization, but luckily there is a newly released industry-wide database that you can rely upon that's accessible for everybody, and that's the Center for Health Design Knowledge Repository, which Ellen is going to be touching on the next slide.
So for all of you who haven't used this tool yet, which I hope you've all been to our website because this really is just a fabulous resource for everyone, if you go to healthdesign.org, on the homepage there is a section that says Knowledge Repository. You can click on that, and what you find is a very easy search mechanism to be able to type in some keywords that will pull up a series of results so that you can look at a range of articles. And within that, you can filter according to whether the full text is available, and that's most likely if it's a report that's been produced by the center, if there's a key point summary available, which I'll talk about in a minute, or if it's just a citation. So you can scroll through the list and then decide which ones you want to click on. If you filter by key point summary, for example, this is a great resource. As Patrick just mentioned, there's just a limited amount of access to some of these research papers for most organizations. So what the center has tried to do is to really create a layman's version of the research article. So for any of you who have read an research article before and have maybe struggled with it a little bit, this tries to distill the key information down. What was the context? What was the objective of the study? What were the methods? What were the findings? So this is a growing body of information. Within a short period of time, we plan on having between 500 and 600 key point summaries out of the 3,000 total citations that are on this database. So I encourage you to take a look and give it a try.
Thanks very much. And those are some tools that are sort of in your toolkit that you can leverage to gather research and make sure it's accurate. But without that appropriate commitment from staff and leadership, it can be somewhat difficult to prioritize findings within the firm. And to support ongoing research efforts, we're seeing a lot of architecture firms designating a research and evidence-based design champion to function as that lead for identifying credible evidence for projects. We've seen a variety of different staff members can serve as a champion. It could be everybody from an architect to planner, interior designer, but somebody on the team that has a research background is best suited to fulfill the two major roles that we list out to the right here. And that is, first, supporting applied research. An evidence-based champion will maintain and evaluate a database of lit reviews. They'll be the one that establishes data collection methods, and they finally write up the results when it's finally ready. Second, they strengthen staff education through training sessions and ongoing guidance to other team members on the evidence-based design process. And in our conversations here, the firms that employ a designated champion, they report they're not only able to complete more comprehensive background research, but they have that in-house point person for conducting studies to build upon the existing body of knowledge that's already out there. of course, the evidence-based design process, it's not just up to one person. It relies upon a multidisciplinary team to support project work. And among other members, this should include everybody from architects to planners, researchers, consultants, staff from the hospital that you're working with, all working together to achieve the goals and objectives of the study. This is a great example from Davis Partnership Architects. They've dedicated not only one but two distinct teams to lead this effort to support evidence-based design. The first team is what they refer to as the Evidence-Based Design Focus Group. Essentially, they're the point of contact for an in-house evidence warehouse. Anybody in the firm can submit a literature request, and then this group completes the desired research and writes up the teaching points, and then sends it back to support individual project work. In contrast, the research focus group here on the right, they're adding to the existing body of knowledge, and they're charged with conducting applied research in individual client projects to understand and evaluate the impact of the built environment on patient outcomes. I think the key takeaway, though, is by developing these designated teams, especially for Davis Partnership Architects, what they've created is a really efficient and scalable research model that can be applied across many, many different projects that they might be working on. So we talked about briefly different ways architecture firms can strengthen capabilities to conduct evidence-based design research, but we know that throughout the process of working on a project, it's essential to have the right ingredients and processes in place at the hospital you're working with. This isn't just at the facilities level. As we've illustrated on the slide, implementing different innovations requires looking at the entire environment of care, and that includes an organization's operations, hospital administration. From the very beginning of the process, it starts at the top. The C-suite and the board of directors need to be engaged so that the vision for the organization moving out 5 or 10 years is aligned with the project's guiding principles. And I think the CEO commitment here is especially critical because that's going to be the person that communicates the link between design and broader organizational strategy. And they also catalyze cultural support for a new design innovation. This is especially important because the culture of an organization is going to influence whether it's feasible and appropriate to apply that evidence, which, as you recall, that's the third step of is it actually applicable in the organization that I'm working with. To give you a sense of just how important an organization's culture is to the application of evidence-based design, I want to turn your attention to two very different experiences by the hospitals on this page. And for those hospitals that are on the line, this illustrates, I think, how important your role is in making sure implementation of different design elements is successful. In this case, both organizations, nonprofit institutions with excellent track record of providing high-quality care, each has made the decision to implement patient lifts. And this is an innovation that works to reduce falls when used appropriately in the optimal scenario within inpatient units. On the left, you see the quote there, the chief nursing officer and hospital management, they've set pretty clear expectations for using the lifts to their full potential. They've provided ongoing support to back implementation. Leadership was a participant on the multidisciplinary project team. In contrast, hospital on the right unfortunately didn't have that buy-in from administrators and end users, in this case the nursing staff. And the result, the patient lifts were failed to realize their anticipated benefits for the hospital. The voice of hospital leadership and frontline staff, not the only one that matters. Certainly in any new construction or renovation project, it's also essential to capture the patient perspective. Gathering feedback and input from patients, families, and the community it offers an opportunity to listen to their experience with the facility, helps identify what do they value and what don't they value, and facilitates that open dialogue that, you want in any project. This is a great example from MedStar Franklin Square Hospital, and it's back to that NICU case that Ellen had talked about. They're using a patient and family advisory council to support their planning efforts around the single family room NICU. As you can see, the patient voice is present throughout the process. And this isn't just a focus group to discuss stories. Patients are actually an active participant in facility visits to other care sites with the architect and with the clinical staff. And that can yield some pretty rich input that directly informs design decisions. Key point here is that I think a truly participatory process that includes interactions with all stakeholders as well as feedback from patients is needed for success in a new construction project. I want to end our presentation today and recognize we're right up on that 2 o'clock time with a brief discussion of what is perhaps the most important element to an evidence-based design process, and that's developing metrics and tools for assessing results. But this can also be the most challenging to ensure that you have valid and reliable instruments that are selected to appropriately evaluate what was the impact of the built environment on patient outcomes. A dedicated researcher here is going to be very important that you can rely upon to help select baseline metrics, but we've included here just three of the major criteria for thinking about what makes a good metric. First is trackability. The metric should be able to be easily defined and capable of being evaluated within the organization over time. Second, validity. We touched upon that, but that's how closely does it evaluate what it's supposed to, and is it an accurate reflection of performance? And lastly, usefulness. Can the organization actually determine what caused the metric to achieve or miss a goal? And will that improvement result in tangible value for the organization? A great way to determine if a metric will indeed result in tangible value is to select those measures that align with an organization's balanced scorecard. And we've illustrated here the key pillars that might be included in a hospital's balanced scorecard for evaluating organizational performance. And you'll notice what's unique here is it's no longer defined. We're not defining value just in terms of your financial ROI. That's certainly a component, but a range of other strategic considerations, the patient experience, the quality of care, staff and operational performance, they're considered in evaluating success and essential in making that link between design and what was the ultimate impact on patient and staff outcomes. These are the different metrics that may be impacted through design, and we recognize that metric selection in any study is going to vary based upon what's the research question you have, what are your study goals, but choosing measures that influence balanced scorecard performance, it helps link the built environment with the longer-term objectives of the hospital. Of course, after implementation of design and construction is complete, a formal post-occupancy evaluation would be conducted to determine what was the impact of the built environment on metric performance, typically done 6 to 12 months after a building is opened. And as we've shown here, this has a number of advantages beyond evaluating the effects of design on your baseline performance metrics. Which is the primary goal, of course, but this is also an opportunity to gather direct feedback from staff. You can share lessons learned from the project to the broader research community if you're able to have a peer-reviewed study published, and then also identifying additional improvement opportunities for your firm. But we know there's a lot of challenges that remain here. It can be very costly to conduct a post-occupancy evaluation. There's also no standard tool or methodology for conducting a post-occupancy evaluation at this time. Lastly, it's also recommended here you bring in a third-party researcher or an institutional review board to assess the tools that you're using in the study, and any study that involves human subjects that's intended to generate publishable results requires that organizations receive that IRB approval. Let's go ahead and move on to takeaways for facility planners and hospitals to end today's presentation. And we wanted to leave you with a summary of the major points we discussed related to evidence-based design. A great page to mark for your future reference here. For hospitals, evidence-based design, it helps ensure that those scarce investment dollars go to the areas that have the greatest return in terms of better patient outcomes. And evidence-based principles, they matter today, but they'll matter even more in the future as providers take on more risk for the quality of care, and there's more and more research out there that demonstrates that link between the built environment and patient outcomes. The case studies we featured this afternoon, that's just a few of the design elements that can make the biggest impact in some of the areas that Ellen focused on, but those, of course, they're just the tip of the iceberg. We also recommend that you strengthen your own capabilities to evaluate and conduct design research. The evidence-based design field definitely constantly changing, and applying an evidence-based process, it provides an opportunity not only to be an informed consumer of research, but also produce studies that move that field forward. And this isn't just for new construction. You can definitely apply and evaluate the impact of design during your next renovation project to offer proof of concept in the design of principles that are being implemented. Lastly, important to recognize that design only one piece of the puzzle. It's also necessary to have the right leadership, culture, and processes in place in the hospital to inflect real change. So that ends the prepared portion of today's presentation. And apologies, we ran a bit over time today, but had a lot of great case studies to share. But want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join us. And I know we received a few questions in the course of the presentation, and we're happy to follow up there after the session with answers to those. One thing I wanted to say before we end today, if you have a moment, please take our feedback survey on today's web conference. We really value your input, and it only takes several minutes to complete here. And lastly, if you are eligible for AIA or evidence-based design and accreditation continuing education units, these forms are available on both the advisory board as well as Center for Health Design website to download. So thank you all again for taking an hour out of your day to join us, and looking forward to continuing the discussion with a lot of our architects.